Thank you, Holly. My name is Helen Harmon, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to say how pleased I am to be here today. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's very nice for me to be invited to Florida in November, because we're already getting snow, and everybody was complaining about the rain, and I thought it was kind of nice. You don't have to shovel it. I also want to thank you for the lovely fruit basket in our room. We arrived a couple of days early, so it's come in really handy for snacks at night, and very much appreciated. I also want to thank Bud and Ann for picking us up at the airport and for their hospitality since, and Teresa, who is an old friend that I've known from Grapevine days, and to Holly, who I just met. It talks in our program that we talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And it's not very difficult at this time of the year for me to remember what it was like. The day that I boarded the plane in Minot, North Dakota, and I should tell you where I am from. I know not all of you are familiar with the Canadian geography. I come from a little town called Mileta in the province of Manitoba, and we're just 16 miles north of the North Dakota border, and we're west of Ontario, so that gives you an idea of where we're located. And I flew out of Minot, North Dakota, and one other time I was going to Mankato, Minnesota for a weekend such as this, and the people that were picking me up at the Minneapolis airport asked for them to check and make sure that I was on the plane coming from Winnipeg. And, of course, I wasn't, and they were kind of panicky until they did a search and found out that I was coming in on a plane from Minot, North Dakota, and they couldn't figure out how I'd got there. But we're just 90 miles north of Minot and 16 miles north of the North Dakota border. So somebody asked me if Canadians drank the same as Americans. I said, yes, I've also drank in the States. I'll also try not to talk too fast, because I know some people here that don't talk too fast. I'm way ahead of you in this Randy prayer. I know that each time we say it. Anyway, on November the 10th, which was Tuesday, and we were boarding the plane at Minot, North Dakota to come down here, it was exactly 22 years to the day that I sobered up in a treatment center in Winnipeg, Manitoba. So as you can see, it's not hard for me to remember what it was like. I can remember as if it was yesterday, my first day in that treatment center, shaken so badly that I couldn't hardly get a glass of orange juice to my mouth to drink, and they wouldn't dare give me a cup of coffee. Not being able to eat because I would just throw it up anyway, and not knowing that I would have been allowed to be sick for a couple of days. So I followed the routine that I was supposed to follow and found out later that I probably could have stayed in bed for a couple of days, which would have been wonderful. But I'd spent a lot of time in a boarding school, and so I knew the routine very well, and when the bells rang, I did what everybody else did. At that time, as I sat in that treatment center those first few days, I really didn't have any hope whatsoever that anything would be any different in my life than what it was right then. Everything that I loved near and dear was going down the drain. I didn't know how to do anything about it, and I was now in this treatment center that was supposed to help me do something about it, but I literally didn't have any hope at that moment that things would improve. And certainly had anybody told me then what I could expect would happen to me in the next 22 years, I would not in any way, shape, or form have believed it. I've had a really good life this last 22 years, and in my wildest dreams, I would not have envisioned some of the things that I've been able to do and the places I've been and the people that I've met. I was brought up in a little country area in the province of Quebec. and I'm not French. As many of you know, the province of Quebec is mostly French. We had a little segment of the province that was totally Irish, and I think that if you're Irish, you've got a good hand on this program, or this disease, I should say, to start with. I was the youngest of six children. Now, my father was hospitalized from about the time I was six, and he died when I was 13, and my mother died when I was 10, so I didn't have a lot of experience with my parents, but I do know that they were not alcoholic. I can remember my dad would buy a quart of beer on a Saturday night, and they would have a glass of beer, and he'd put the cap on it and put it away till the next Saturday night. However, there was a story that my grandparents had not wanted my mother to marry this man because a lot of his relatives were drunks. I'm the youngest of six, and you know when they say that if you shake any family tree, an alcoholic will fall out? Well, when you shake our family tree, the whole family falls out. My oldest sister sobered up three times in Alcoholics Anonymous, and today she finds her strength in the church, which is all right. I have no quarrels with that. My next brother arrived at my place in Manitoba one time, about 12 years ago now, I guess. And how he got there, I don't know. He didn't know where he'd been or where he was going. And I think God just looked after him and brought him to my place. And through the help of a naturopathic doctor friend who happened to be an AA member, we got him help. And today he doesn't drink and he lives on a disability pension and he manages quite well. My next brother was sober for 12 years when he decided that maybe he could have a glass of wine at weddings. And soon found out that that didn't work because he was passed out in the pub and his children, who had never really seen him drink, didn't appreciate that very much, and he sobered up and has, I guess, what I tend to call white knuckle sobriety. My next brother keeps falling on and off the wagon, and when he falls off, he gets in trouble. And I've tried many times to carry the message to him, but, you know, they seem to think that Alcoholics Anonymous is wonderful for me, but they're not about to try it. My next sister, who's just older than I am, I think is one of those people who stopped in time. She certainly saw the rest of us go through our drinking, and I saw her in action a few times too, and today she doesn't drink and literally avoids it like the plague. So that tells me that she's not a social drinker. And then there was me, and I didn't have any problems. I went, because my mother died when I was 10, my sister and I went to a convent boarding school, and I spent 5 years there, and I had a good life. I have no qualms about saying that my life in the convent was good. The nuns knew that our parents were gone and they treated us very well. I don't know that I got a good education in the realities of everyday living, but I didn't see any booze in the convent either, although maybe there was some, but I didn't see it. So alcohol wasn't a problem for me at that point. I got my grade 12, took a commercial course. I was working by the time I was 16. And that was merely because my youngest brother had kept the farm going until we were through school, and it was kind of a disaster, so he finally sold out and went on to a better job, and it was like kind of go to work because there was nobody to pay for any further schooling. And at that time, we didn't have the government programs that we have today, and I'm not sure that I would have taken advantage of them. I think all I really wanted to do was to be able to get a good job, which I did. I worked for a couple of years in Ottawa, and then I moved to Manitoba because my oldest sister was living there, and I went out to visit her, and I decided that I would stay there and work. And then I got married, and I was just 18, and that marriage lasted 7 years, and it had nothing to do with my alcoholism. At that time, I liked to party. In our part of the province of Quebec, in this little Irish settlement, we did a lot of dancing and singing. And I moved out there, and when they suggested going to a party, I thought, great, you know. And I said, who's playing? Like, the first thing we always did was look for somebody to play the fiddle and the guitar. And I found that their parties was to get a swallow a beer and go to somebody's place and have a few beers and sit around and talk. It wasn't exactly my kind of a party at all, but that's what was done there, and so I got into that routine. But I didn't like beer. I didn't like the taste of it, and I couldn't drink enough of it to get any kind of a high, so it didn't appeal to me at all. Somebody told me one time that if you drank beer out of a teaspoon, that, you know, you'd get a little bit of a glow on, and I tried that. And I was told if you drank it out of a straw, that that would also give you a good glow, and I tried that. I think the only thing that that indicates to me is that I never was a social drinker. The only time I ever drank was I drank for the effect that alcohol would do for me, that it would make me somebody that I wasn't. I was a very shy person, and after a few drinks, I could hold my own in any conversation. So beer really wasn't the thing, but we couldn't get hard liquor in the hotels in Manitoba at that time. In fact, at that time, women weren't even allowed in the hotels in Manitoba. But like I told you, we're only 16 miles from the North Dakota border, and it was quite easy to run across the line in an evening, and you could go into the bars there, and you could drink hard liquor, which I thought was great, because a couple of drinks of hard liquor and I would be feeling good and I'd have this nice warm glow on. But inevitably, you know, I would take that extra drink, which just put me over the edge, and then I'd be sick going home, and that would be the end of that night. I'd be sick and I'd go to bed. And at that time in my life, I didn't pursue it the next day. It wasn't something that I looked for the next day to continue the party or anything. I was sick and the game was over for that period of time. But that was my pattern of drinking. It wasn't to go out and just have a nice evening. To give you an example, I can remember one time we went across the line and we decided we'd have something different. And so we ordered a martini. And I took a drink of this martini and, that was horrible stuff. Now, the average social drinker that I see today, you know, would have set that glass aside, waited until somebody ordered something else and got another drink. But not me. I think I was already showing the signs of alcoholism because I drank it, like in about 2 mouthfuls to get rid of it so that I could order something else. And that was, to me, you know, the type of drinking I did. It certainly wasn't social drinking. It wasn't, you know, well, I'll just have a drink to be nice. I always wanted to drink for the effect. My marriage broke up after 7 years, and that was when my drinking started. And that was when I got into, I guess, the alcoholic drinking. I was very angry, and I was very resentful, and I was full of self-pity, because I was 25 years of age, my marriage was over, I had been brought up a strict Catholic, which meant you didn't get a divorce, and so all I could see was, you know, a lonely life ahead of me with just me. And we didn't have any children, and it was probably just as well in time to come, because I wouldn't have looked after them very well anyway. I had a good job. There was no problem that way. I had a very good job, and I liked my job. And so there was no reason for me to really have all these negative feelings. I didn't have to worry about kids at home, and I had a good job. So my drinking pattern, I guess, then started rather innocently enough in that I would pick up a six-pack of beer after work and go home to my apartment and read the paper and have a couple of beers and have supper and probably go to bed. But it didn't take too long before I was picking up the six-pack of beer, taking it home, drinking the six-pack while I read the paper, forgetting about supper, and then going downtown to continue drinking with whoever I could find to drink with. And at that time, the pubs in our area closed at 11 o'clock at night. Well, as my drinking progressed, of course, that 11 o'clock at night was too early, and there was always somebody willing to buy a 12 or a 24 and carry the party on someplace else. And so eventually it got that, you know, I wouldn't get home till 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever. And then I started going to work with a hangover and missing work and the usual things. And it also got to the point where the six-pack wasn't enough after work, because beer never was my drink of choice. I drank it when I couldn't afford to drink anything else, And eventually I drank liquor when I couldn't afford to drink anything else either, like other than beer, but I still bought the Mickey of whiskey, and that gave me a little more false courage. Naturally, my job suffered because of my late nights and missed a lot of work. And then along around this time, like I figure I drank for about 7 years, and out of the 7 years, 4 of them were totally out of control drinking. And so somewhere along the line, I met the man who's today my husband, and we lived common law for 3 years before we could be married, before my divorce was final. And of course, this was in the 60s when living common law wasn't the in thing to do. But that's what we did. And of course, I had a lot of guilt feelings over this because it was totally opposed to the way I'd been brought up. Dick likes to have a drink, and so the first night, you know, he brings home a bottle of wine, and we're going to have a glass of wine before dinner, and which we do, but then, you know, he wants to eat supper. And when you still got half a bottle of wine, who wants to bother with supper? It didn't take him too long to smarten up, and he quit buying the bottle of wine. But then I started buying the bottle of wine. The only difference was that I bought two. One that I put in the fridge to have a drink with him when he came home from work, and the other one that I hid in the closet. And it didn't take him too long to figure out why I would get so drunk on one glass of wine before dinner. And that became the beginning of me hiding bottles and him finding bottles. And I used to have liquor hid all over the place. I would go through a panic on the weekend because our liquor commission was closed on Mondays. And I would usually buy enough liquor to get me through a weekend. But, you know, if I drank more of it than I figured on Saturday night, which inevitably happened, or on Sunday, I wouldn't have any left for Monday, and I would be in a total panic. And I remember at different times going through the house frantically searching for a bottle that I thought I had hidden someplace, only to either not find it at all and realize with, you know, utter desperation that I had drank it, or with sheer joy when I found that I hadn't drank it, I just moved it to a better hiding place. And the worst part of that was when Dick found the hidden bottle or bottles, and instead of confronting me with it and pouring them down the sink, because that was good for a good fight, when he just put them on the table and never said a word. It's pretty hard to argue with that. My downhill slide went very quickly, and I quit work at my job just prior to being fired, because there was many, many days. I worked for a GM dealership as the bookkeeper and office manager. I worked upstairs. I was the only one in the office most of the time. And there was lots of days when I did absolutely nothing but twiddle my thumbs and wait for 5 o'clock, because I would be so hungover that I couldn't possibly balance figures, let alone look at them. And amazingly, you know, about 4:30, I'd start to come to life. Because that morning I would have promised myself that I was going home 5 o'clock, I was going straight to bed, and I would be in better shape the next morning. But that didn't always happen. Usually about 4:30 I'd start to come to life, and well, maybe I'll just stop and have one, or maybe I'll just go by the liquor commission and get a Mickey, and maybe I'll just have one drink, and then I'll be okay. And of course, you know what happened. Never ever stopped at one. So I quit my job just ahead of being fired. My boss, who was a very kind, understanding man, had just about had all he was going to take, and I realized that, and so I quit. And for the next year, I didn't work, and all that did was allow me to drink behind closed doors and drawn drapes, because when I had to go to work, I always had to put on that semblance of pulling myself together, getting cleaned up, and going to work. And when I wasn't working, you know, I didn't have to do that. And I think my husband got very tired of living on tins, cans of soup. My house was a disaster, and, you know, I just couldn't do anything. I just, for one thing, didn't have the energy to do anything. But then to you know, tell you how sick probably my boss was. He asked me if I'd come back and work on a part-time basis. And I thought that would be a good idea. I'd just go in and do the month-end work. But that didn't work out so well either, because when I was supposed to be there to do the month-end work, that would be when I'd be sick and hungover. And when I was maybe in not bad shape, they didn't need me. So that was kind of at the stage I was at the last year of my drinking. And I ended up in the hospital in Mileta probably around July. I'm not exactly sure. And probably as much from malnutrition as from alcoholism, because I'd got to the point where I couldn't eat. I just couldn't literally force food down. Now, I'm 5'11" in my stocking feet. When I got to this program, I weighed 108 pounds. That's 50 pounds less than what I weigh today. So I was nothing but a walking skeleton. When you live in a town of 1,200 or 1,300 people, you don't have many secrets either. And the doctor knew, of course, just by reputation, let alone anything else, that I was a drinker. So he put me in the hospital. I was there about a week or 10 days, and he came by one day after I'd been there a while and got the cobwebs out of my head and told me that I would have to quit drinking. He said, if you don't, you know, 6 months down the road, I don't know what kind of a diagnosis I'll have for you, but it probably won't be very good. He scared me enough, but I said, if I have to quit drinking, I can quit drinking, because he had said, I can get some people to come in and talk to you. Now, at this point in time, I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never allowed myself to think that I might need that organization someday. Nothing. And yet I knew that that's exactly what the doctor was talking about. And I said, if I have to quit drinking, I can quit drinking. I don't need any help. And he left it at that. And a few days later, he released me from the hospital. And I went home. And I did the usual thing I think that most alcoholic women do, is the first thing, I cleaned my house from top to bottom. You know, everything to extremes. Shaken like a leaf, but you know, I'm going to do all these things that I had neglected for months. And I went back to work, because my boss knew that I was a good worker when I wasn't drinking, and so he was only too happy to have me come when I was sober. And that sobriety then lasted maybe for a couple of weeks. And I remember that one Saturday afternoon I was cleaning my house, and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon I had everything done, supper in the oven, and I thought, I'll just reward myself with a bottle of beer. And when Dick came home, I decided I would be honest with him and tell him that I had this bottle of beer. And I don't know why all of a sudden honesty became important, because it never had been before. And I'll never forget the look on his face, and I couldn't understand why he was so upset because I'd had one bottle of beer. But of course he knew what I didn't know, was that this would be the start of the drinking again. And I didn't pursue it, you know, I had become, before this time, before ending up in the hospital, I had become a daily drinker. Somebody had told me one time that if you have a drink in the morning, that would clear your head and you'd be good for the day. Well, naturally, I tried that, and I became a daily drinker, starting with the first drink in the morning. I had a drink in the morning, and always was going to quit, but it was always like next week. So I had become a daily drinker. But I didn't pursue that daily drinking after I got out of the hospital. After I had that one bottle of beer, I probably didn't have any more for a while, because the doctor really had scared me. The next occasion that really focuses in my mind was Thanksgiving. Our Thanksgiving is in October. And I had always had Thanksgiving for the family, or we had. And so on the Saturday, I was busy cooking for this Sunday dinner that we were going to have. And I was cooking a ham. And somebody had told me that if you put wine on the ham, it gives it a nice flavor. So I went over to the Liquor Commission and bought a bottle of wine. We only lived a block and a half from the Liquor Commission. I bought the bottle of wine and I put half of it on the ham. So, well, what do you do with an open half bottle of wine, you know? Especially if you're an alcoholic. And, of course, I drank it. and went back to the Liquor Commission to get the rest of my supply for the weekend, because that certainly wasn't enough, and just about ruined Thanksgiving for the whole family. The other thing that is very clear in my mind is just right after Thanksgiving, and I had always read the Winnipeg Tribune paper, and there was a column in there by Gene Taupner, and that weekend he had written about the AA conference, which had been held in Winnipeg, and which was always held in Winnipeg on Thanksgiving weekend. And he was talking about, or writing about, what wonderful people these were, and the program, etc. Again, I had no conscious thought of joining Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think for one minute that I might need you down the road. That had never entered my head. Still didn't enter my head. But I like to think that it was God, as I understand him today, getting me ready for that day that was coming very shortly, when I was going to need you people. I remember getting up, getting the scissors, cutting that article out of the paper, and I've never found it again. I don't know what I did with it, but I never found it. But I remember distinctly doing that. Glass in hand, mind you. Glass sitting by my chair. Glass in hand, but cutting that out of the paper. And that was the middle of October. My belly button birthday is on the 2nd of November, and I recall we went out to dinner, and we might have had a glass of wine. Nothing more than that, because the next day I went to work, and I remember thinking to myself, now you've got this thing under control here, you know. I was patting myself on the back. We'd gone out to dinner, had a nice dinner, had one glass of wine, went home, was feeling good. I was at work the next day, doing my job the way I was supposed to. Well, my husband's birthday is the 8th of November, and that arrived on a Sunday that year. And I had invited some people in, some of our bowling friends, as a way of celebrating his birthday for supper on the Sunday night. Now, I probably started to drink on the Friday night, drank to the extent on Saturday that I wouldn't go over town to buy him a birthday present. But, of course, I could go to the Liquor Commission a block and a half away without too many people seeing me, and got my supply. And Sunday, these people are supposed to be coming for supper. I'm supposed to be cooking dinner. And I was in no shape to do it. And for the first time, Dick made me responsible for my own actions and told me to phone these people and cancel the invitation, because he said, I won't have you embarrass me again. And I forgot one significant fact. The year before that, on the 1st of October, 1969, we had got married. Now, I was a full-blown alcoholic when we got married. But Dick figured, because of the guilt that I felt about us living together, etc., that everything would change once we got married. And the day of our marriage, I'm sorry to say, I had liquor hidden all over the house. Fortunately, I didn't get a chance to drink it, because there was people coming and going all day. And so I was relatively sober when we got married. But that wasn't by my good deeds. So this is now a year and a month later. And he just said he wouldn't have me embarrass him again. And so I made those phone calls, because I knew also that I wasn't in shape to entertain that night. And I made the phone calls and made the excuse, and I went to bed. And this was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I woke up at 8 o'clock. Now, this is November, and it's dark. And I didn't know whether it was 8 o'clock at night or 8 o'clock in the morning. But I heard the TV on, and I presumed it was night. And I just stayed in bed. And when Dick came to bed, I pretended to be sleeping, because we'd had a pretty good argument. You know, I didn't just go to bed without, you know, trying to defend myself. But also, when I wakened up at 8 o'clock, I knew what I'd done to that man that day. I knew that everything I loved near and dear was going down the tubes. And when he came to bed, I just didn't say anything, and I pretended to be asleep. But that has to be the longest night that I've ever put in, because I alternated between cold sweats and hot sweats, dreading the night but dreading the morning more. And finally, morning came, and he got up to go to work. And I was supposed to be at work that morning too. But I waited until he left the house. And I got up and I went to the fridge. And there was a bottle of liquor in the fridge. He had quit, you know, keeping it out of the house because he knew I would get it anyway. I poured myself a drink, and I sat down to drink it, and it didn't do a thing for me. Nothing. I got up and I went and I poured myself the second drink, and I didn't touch it. I went to the phoned my place of employment, where I knew that one of the mechanics that worked in the back shop had gone to AA. Now again, up to that moment, even with that first drink, even with how desperate I felt all night, even with how sick I was, I never once thought, maybe in the morning I'll call Alcoholics Anonymous. Never once crossed my mind. And yet, when I poured that second drink, I walked to the phone, phoned the garage, and asked if Al would come and see me. And again, like, I didn't sort of allow myself to know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet I knew, because I'd asked somebody one time, Al always filled his car up with gas on Tuesday nights, and I said, where does Al go? And they said, oh, he goes to Souris to an AA meeting, and Souris is a town down the road about 55 miles. Al made a few phone calls before he came to the house, and on the way to our house, he and the gentleman he brought with him, who was a good friend of mine, had stopped and talked to Dick, and he said, well, if you can do anything with her, go ahead, because I've had it. I can't get through to her. So they came to the house, and Al had told me that he'd phoned, and he had made arrangements for me to go into a treatment center. And I would have to go to Winnipeg. And Winnipeg is 200 miles from where I live, and we didn't just normally go to Winnipeg. And he said I would be there for 3 weeks, and I said, my God, 3 weeks? I can't go to Winnipeg for 3 weeks. I don't know what I thought I was doing that was so important that I couldn't go to Winnipeg for 3 weeks. But then he said the magic words that got me there, and I don't know whether this is good advice or bad advice, but it certainly got me to where I needed to go. He said to me, tell Dick to go to the liquor commission and get you a bottle, drink it, and forget it. When Dick came home, I said to him, Al said you're to go to the liquor commission and get me a 26. I wasn't going out on any Mickey. And Dick couldn't figure out how come I was going away for alcohol treatment, but he was supposed to go to the liquor commission and get me a bottle. But he did it, and thank God he did, because I don't know to this day whether I would have made that trip without that bottle. He took me from Melitta to Brandon, which is 90 miles, and we met a man there who worked for the Alcoholism Treatment Foundation of Manitoba, and he was an AA member, and he took us from Brandon to Winnipeg. And I don't know if he hadn't have been with us, whether I'd have gone in those doors or not. Because, you know, by the time we got there, I hadn't had a drink from Brandon to Winnipeg, and I'm getting shaky and teary, and I'm feeling sorry for myself, and I'm not sure what I would have done. But I wasn't in there very long when the girls that resided, there was about 15, had been out to a meeting, and they were coming back and coming into the house and introducing themselves as an alcoholic. And I guess it was like somebody had lifted a weight off my shoulders. All of a sudden, you know, I wasn't alone anymore. And there was something tangible wrong with me. You know, they were saying they were an alcoholic. By this time, and from that day forward, I never had any problems admitting that I was an alcoholic. I certainly had to learn to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic. And more importantly, I think for me, I had to surrender to the fact that I was an alcoholic. I could not, in the wildest dreams, think that someday down the road I might be able to drink. I had to surrender to this thing that I was an alcoholic, and that if I was going to do anything about my life, that maybe I better make these 3 weeks work for me. And thank God I had that attitude almost from day one, because I think that that's what got me to where I am today. That I was able to totally surrender and say, yes, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drunk. And nobody, but nobody likes a drunken woman. And when you live in a town, as I say, of 1,200 or 1,300 people, you know, everybody knew I was a drunk. And when I went to treatment, I'm sure they all knew where I went before I did. It was, you know, they knew I was a drunk. And it wouldn't have surprised anybody that they'd hauled me away, you know, to an alcohol nut house. I was known in the town. I mean, I wasn't a closet drinker. Everybody in town knew me. I had fallen down drunk in the pub, in the Legion Hall, on the street. You know, it's not a pretty sight. But I decided then and there that I would try and make the most of that 3 weeks in Winnipeg, because the other thing I knew, there was two things. Winnipeg was 200 miles away. We didn't make that trip very often in those days. I didn't know for sure that whether there was an AA group in my town, and I found out shortly after that there was. But I knew one thing, I knew it very clearly, and I found out afterwards that I was exactly right. I was the first woman AA member in a radius of 200 miles. 110 miles west to Estevan and 90 miles east to Brandon, there weren't any other women in the program. And I always thank God for Dr. Pincock, who was the psychiatrist that treated us in River House, and he said to me, you're not the only woman alcoholic out there. He said, you may be the only admitted one. You've got to go home and hold your head up, because those other people need somebody to follow. And when I went home from that treatment center and walked downtown, and the lady said to me, we don't see you at the Legion for cribbage on Wednesday nights. And I said, oh no, I usually go to Brandon on Wednesday nights. And she said, oh, that's where you have to go for those meetings. I said, no, as a matter of fact, we have one right here in town on Tuesday nights. Because I knew right from the beginning that I had to let people know exactly what I was doing, because they knew what I was doing before. And I certainly don't shout it from the rooftops, but I'm not anonymous in that town. I've come. So I made the best of those 3 weeks. I listened to everything that was said, and I went home with great trepidation, no doubt. I had been brought up very religiously, but I had got a long ways away from God. I remember some nights falling into bed so drunk and so full of pills I could hardly navigate, and thinking, maybe if I tried praying, and just as quickly putting it out of my mind with, but he wouldn't listen anyway. And I don't know where I got that idea, because I don't think that that's what I was taught. But I had to find a higher power that I could relate to on a daily basis. Somebody told me, because we say the Lord's Prayer all the time, that if you think of God as your father wouldn't purposely hurt you. Now, I didn't know my father very well, but I knew that he had been good to me and that he wouldn't purposely hurt me. And so I had to come to a degree of understanding that this God that I thought I could believe in would be like my father and would help me as much as he could and wouldn't purposely hurt me. And I started trying to just talk to him on a daily basis. Again, I'd been brought up in organized religion and organized prayers, and I decided somehow that that wasn't right for me, that I would never memorize a prayer again. And I went home, and I didn't know, you know, how do you make a decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of God as you understand them? And I found I didn't understand them very well, so I really had to work at step 11 and try and seek through prayer and meditation. And I started using, to begin with, the 24-hour book, and then I graduated to the little book as Bill sees it, which I still use today, and I sometimes use the Daily Reflections book. But to me, the book as Bill sees it has always been my favorite. And I started out using that book every morning and just trying to ask God to guide me through the day and first and foremost keep me sober. And at a meeting one night, somebody said, well, I like the prayer that's given to us in the big book. step three. And I went home and got my big book out and read it, and I thought, yeah, that's right. That says exactly what I want to say. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, may I do thy will always. And I started using that prayer every morning. And when I was leaving River House, the house mother there had given me a bookmark with the prayer of St. Francis on it. And I later found, of course, that the prayer of St. Francis is given to us in the 12 and 12 in step 11. And I started using that prayer, and I use them to this day. And I really believe to this day that it's that little bit of prayer and meditation that I do in the morning, and I don't spend a lot of time doing it. And sometimes I miss altogether. And sometimes I do it when I'm walking down the beach when I'm in Florida. Sometimes I do it sitting out in a boat in the lake in northern Manitoba. But I try to do that little bit of conscious contact with God every day. And I really believe that that is what has made my life what it is today. I didn't think it was possible to stay sober 2 months, let alone 22 years. When I was in River House, they were going to celebrate the anniversary of River House in January of that coming year. And one of the girls that was in there with me, had just gone in before I did, was the 1,000th girl to go through the house. And Eleanor, the house mother, said to her, "And we'll want you at that celebration, and God help you if you get drunk," tongue in cheek, of course. And I remembered thinking to myself, my God, that's 2 months away. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to drink anymore, but I didn't think it was possible not to. And also while I was there, Eleanor had celebrated her third birthday, and I thought, 3 years, my God, it's not possible to go without drinking for 3 years. I knew when I went in there, and I wasn't going to drink anymore, that I was never, ever going to have any fun in my life again. And the last 22 years have been the best years of my life, bar none. Because my young years were not good. My mother was sick for a long time. My dad was sick. They both died when I was young. My years in the convent were okay, but, you know, nothing spectacular. And, of course, my drinking years were terrible. I couldn't talk to people without a drink. I couldn't have a good time. I couldn't, you know, just be myself. I didn't think I would ever have any fun again. And yet, the last 22 years have just been beyond my wildest dreams. And so I went home to a group that had 4 people in it. And I started going to meetings. And thank God there was one member there that went to a lot of other meetings, went to a lot of different meetings. And within a radius of Mileta, within a 50-mile radius, you can get a meeting almost any night. And we went further than that. We went 75 miles. But I started going to Brandon on Wednesday nights to a women's group. Because this man that had taken me from Brandon to Winnipeg to the treatment center had said to me, "Helen, there's a women's group in Brandon and they need your help." So automatically I was there. And I went to that meeting every Wednesday night for a year. Now, I came home from River House on the 3rd of December, 1970, and we never missed a Wednesday night in Brandon. This other man would like to go to meetings. He would take his car 1 week, and I'd take mine the next, and he'd go to the jail meeting or the mental hospital meeting, and I'd go to the women's group. And this was winter. This was snow, blizzard, 30 below, whatever. But we went. And I went to Kern of Saskatchewan, which was 40 miles away, and Hartney and all the little towns around. And I met a lot of people. And I got involved. And I think, again, that that's what has paid the dividends for me today. And I was 11 months sober when this conference was being held in Winnipeg again, the one that I had read about. And when I was in River House, I'd heard a lot about that conference. And I had sort of made myself a promise then that I was going to be back there the next year for that conference. I don't know how I figured I'd be there, because I didn't know that I could stay sober that long. But lo and behold, I was going to this conference. And this man said to me, they're going to have an AA assembly in Winnipeg with a conference, and you should represent our group. And I said, what do I do? And he said, well, you just go to the meeting and you tell them that we've got four members or maybe five, and we meet on Tuesday nights in the United Church basement. And I said, well, I think I can handle that. So away I went, and I had to, I was on this women's panel on Saturday morning, and when it was over, I went into this room where it said AA General Service and opened the door and went in, and I didn't know anybody, or I didn't think I knew anybody. And they were having an election, and I thought, no, I don't know anything about this. No point in me staying around, so I left. And that afternoon on the program, there was a general service meeting, and there was two trustees, one by the name of Tom G., which I'm sure a lot of you know, and another fellow by the name of Matt from Calgary, Alberta, were speaking at this service meeting. And I thought, well, that doesn't interest me, so I'll have a sleep. Well, that's on. Well, you know what it's like when you go to your first roundup or conference and you get all keyed up and drink too much coffee and there's no such thing as sleep. So for something one better to do, I went to that meeting at 2 o'clock on the Saturday afternoon. And those two men at that time were trustees on the General Service Board, and they sold me a bill of goods that afternoon that I've been buying ever since. And I went home and said to our group, you know, there's more to this than just these meetings. Like, we should have a service manual. And of course, I was off and running. But again, it's been a very important part of my life, and I think I would be remiss not to mention that because, you know, of becoming sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, because of getting involved at my group level, and because of getting out and going to other meetings and taking an active part, it always kind of bothers me when people say, you know, and you ask them if they go to meetings, and they say, no, but I'm doing fine. You know, I'm doing good. I don't need the meetings anymore. I'm doing fine. And I think back to that little group of ours, and it's no different today than it was then. I think we have about 12 members today. And we've sobered up a lot of people in the 22 years that I've been there. But they keep moving away. They keep moving on to bigger and better things. And we stay about the same. But we're always working with new people. And I think if nobody had been there, if everybody had said, you know, well, I'm doing okay, I don't need to go to the meetings, out of those four or five people, where would I be, you know? Where would I be today? And so I always have to remember that. And I had the privilege of serving this fellowship as the delegate for Manitoba, and then later on as the trustee at large for Canada. And I followed in the footsteps of Mac Cheater, and I'm sure a lot of you remember Mac. And I was a delegate when he was rotated off the board as trustee, and we were going home on the plane to Winnipeg together. And I said to him, Mac, what are you going to do now? Because you've been so busy. And of course, Mac was a phenomenal speaker, so he was invited all over the place to speak. And he said to me, you know, the only trustees that I ever knew that had a problem when they rotated off the board were the ones who had quit going to their group meetings. And he said, I never quit going to my group, so I don't have to go back to anything. I just have to keep doing what I'm doing. And I'll tell you, I kept that in mind when I was on the board, and I don't miss very many Tuesday nights at our group meeting, and I'm usually there making the coffee or washing the dishes or doing something else that needs to be done, because that is where the bread and butter of Alcoholics Anonymous is with the home group, and we need somebody there to have the handout to say to the newcomer, you know, you're welcome. They read the promises a little bit, and I'm just going to close with a little bit on the promises, because to me they've been so important in my life too. And I know there's a lot of steps in between there, step three that I ended with, and step nine where these start. And I just want to mention something about step nine. And of course I'd done the list and whatnot, and this man that I had worked for a lot of years had, you know, welcomed me back to work sober, because he knew I'd been a good employee and that I could be a good employee again sober. And one year, in fact, the day of my anniversary, first anniversary, I had a phone call from a man from Brandon wanting to know if I would be interested in setting up a little income tax business. And I said, well, I don't have time to talk to you tonight. I didn't tell him where I was going, but I had more important things to do. I said, put it in a letter and I'll take a look at it. And as a result of that, I got into the income tax business, but worked it out of my boss's office, and he was very congenial with that. And in 79, he sold the garage, and I moved out into my own business. And But he's a very good friend. But there was an amend that I had to make to that man, and I had to tell him, you know, all the dollars that he had paid me for nothing. And I was sober about 3 years before I was able to do that. And I had tried too many times, and I would say to him, Ken, you know, we got to sit down and talk because there's some things that you don't know. And he'd always say, oh, but you're doing such a good job now. That's in the past. Forget it. And so I'd kind of take the easier, softer way, and I'd forget it for another period of time. But that little, you know, knot in the stomach was where I live. It tells me when I'm not doing something right, and eventually, you know, every time I'd think about this. So I finally sat him down, and I told him exactly, you know, what I'd done and all the time that I'd spent not doing anything and all the other things. And when I was finished, he said, well, that's good. I'm glad you told me all that. But he said, that's in the past now. He said, we won't think of it again. We'll just go on. And that man has become one of my best friends, him and his wife. And in 1990, I was in Seattle for the conference there, and some friends of mine that were with me had never been to Victoria. So we took the little boat across to Victoria, and I had made arrangements for them to meet me, and I had dinner with them. And, you know, there was just so much love, and he has always loved Alcoholics Anonymous because he has seen not only what it did for me, but what it's done for so many other people. And I guess that's why, to me, the promises are so important, because they have come true in my life, and they can come true in each and every one of our lives. And it says that we are painstaking about this phase of our development, and I don't consider that what I did and how I've worked the program has been very painstaking, and yet I've been dedicated to it, and I know how important it is to work the steps and to go to meetings and to read the book. And I've always tried to put that first in my life and my Tuesday night meetings. And people in my town know, you know, they don't schedule anything for me on a Tuesday night because I have something much more important to do. But it says we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And I often think of Dr. Martin Luther King saying, free, you know, free at last. Thank God we're free at last. And I often think that for myself. Thank God I'm free at last. Free of that vice that held me, that alcohol vice that held me for so many years and didn't allow me to do anything. I used to think that happiness came in dollar bills and holidays, new cars and new house and that kind of thing. Somebody told me one time that happiness is like a butterfly. The more you pursue it, the more it'll elude you. But if you stand quietly and let it happen, it'll come and sit on your shoulder. And all the time I was out there trying so hard to find happiness, I couldn't find it. But when I started just living my life a day at a time and trying to live a better life, you know, happiness found me. I always say, too, that one of the biggest gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me was one day at a time, because I never did anything one day at a time. I was always making lists of what I was going to do 3 weeks down the road, but I never thought of doing something just for today, because I'd have a list for this week, and by Wednesday, if I didn't have Monday and Tuesday stuff done, I'd say, well, to heck with this week, we'll try again next week. Literally what I did. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And there's lots of things about my past that I regret, but I know that it's the biggest asset that I have today. The biggest asset for me in a lot of cases is my past. And through that, I can help somebody else to identify in this program and to find the help that I've found. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. And believe me, I was a long ways down that scale. I hit bottom pretty hard, and I know that it doesn't have to be that way. And I'm just thankful that I didn't have to drink any more years than what I drank, because I've seen a lot of people who are still out there drinking that I drank with and have never, you know, been able to find this program. And it's so sad because, you know, their life is in the later stages, and they still haven't found that peace of mind and contentment and serenity. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear, and I certainly don't feel useless anymore, and I don't have place in my life anymore for self-pity. I used to wallow around in that self-pity, you know. I had everybody crying for me, you know. And today, I haven't got time for self-pity. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Sometimes I sit back and I think I'm not the same person. I'm just literally not the same person that I was when I drank. I don't think the same way. I don't feel the same way. You know, so I have literally changed my whole life and my whole way of thinking and whatever else. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. And I used to put doctors and ministers and lawyers and that up there, and I was down here. And, you know, I found out that they're only human beings too, just like we are. And now I can talk to them on their level because I don't have to put myself down. I don't have to think of myself as being either better or inferior to anybody. I'm just me. I'm just a human being, and I'm just the same as anybody else. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us, and we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. I could take another hour to tell you just on that last sentence, situations which used to baffle us, and things that I've been allowed to do as a result of being sober in this program. One instance that comes to mind very quickly, I had a sister and her husband and their whole five children who were in a very severe accident in 1972. I wasn't sober yet 2 years. And my other sister and I went down east to be with Sam and family and whatnot, and my sister that was living out here was drinking at the time. We got there and my sister's in-laws were drinking and taking pills and nobody was dealing with anything. And because of this program and help of a God that I, you know, understand today and can relate to today and talk to, I was able to do some things that I know and that I was used by God to do some things that resulted in her life being saved and that of her children's and her husband's. And my sister had five kids, and, you know, it wasn't going to be very good if the mother was taken from those five kids, which ranged from 2 to 15. And because I was sober in this program, you know, I feel that I was used directly to make some decisions. There's been many other instances in my life. And I've been able to take a place in my community, and Bill W. talks about that we've become citizens again. And as I said, in my town, the people don't schedule anything for me on a Tuesday night because they know I'm not available that night. But they also know, and they have recognized in their own way, that I have something to offer to that community that a lot of other people don't have, and that I can be an example. And I think that, you know, that's I'm not saying those things that mean that I've been able to do anything special. What I am saying is that because of this program, because of a God that I now understand a little better, and because of you people, I've been able to do things in my life that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. I thank you for having me. I hope that something I have said has helped somebody here today. Thank you very much.